Hi. Before I begin, I want you to know that there are a few printed copies of my sermon that the ushers have. So if you would like to have a printed copy of what I'm reading from, the ushers will appear and you can indicate to them that that would be helpful. I know that sometimes that's useful. It's so nice to see all of you. Great. Excellent. Cool. Excellent. Those printed copies are coming around if that's useful. Perhaps you've heard the jokes about UUs and uncertainty. Some focus on the difficulty of categorizing UU devotional practice. Question: to whom do UUs address their prayers? Answer: to whom it may concern. Others reference UU's love of debate and discussion. Question: what do you get if you put two UUs together? Answer: three opinions. Additional jokes riff on UU's encouragement of other members of their community, human and non-human, in personal searches for meaning. Question: why did the UU cross the road? Answer: to support the chicken in its search for its own path. They also include, of course, the variations on the light bulb joke. You've all heard the light bulb joke. Question: how many UUs does it take to change a light bulb? First answer: as many as will agree to serve on the light bulb changing committee. Second answer: none. We accept the light bulb the way it is. Or my personal favorite, the third answer: UUs aren't afraid of the dark. UUs are excellent at building infrastructure to support uncertainty as a practice, as a desire always to learn more. We have a reputation for our love of organizing forums for discussion, debate, and exchange as a means to encourage a collective and responsible search for truth, often to the point of superabundance. In cynical moments, my mother, when asked what UUs believe in, says that they believe in meetings. Uncertainty is a deliberate and necessary tool for UUs. It's one of the primary ways that the UU tradition builds into its practice a regular commitment to asking questions, to working together, so that each person might figure out what is right and true for them as it changes. We hold ourselves up to being a living tradition. Within the language of the living tradition is the expectation that we are each in a state of constant change, and that everything in our lives that isn't us is also changing. A commitment to a living tradition is a commitment to having a practice of being attentive and thoughtful and thinking critically, such that when a serious change occurs, you have a practice to help guide you through it. I want, in this sermon, to build from the language of the living tradition in order to think about how UUs harness and devote ourselves to uncertainty, about how we use it as an asset rather than as an invitation to fear. I want to think, too, about what being devoted to uncertainty looks like. I understand change to be both about preparation, orienting towards what's coming, and about managing what's here. What could a living tradition, a faith-based community denominationally oriented towards sustainably anticipating and living with change, mean? Waiting for change runs the risk of being a form of stasis. How do we manage our waiting, which is full of change we might not be able to anticipate, without exhausting ourselves or looking endlessly forward in a way that detracts from our experience of the present? For UUs, a commitment to being prepared for change is bound up in a collective commitment towards social awareness and participation, toward a sense of responsibility in searching for information about the present moment in local, national, and international contexts. Change for us means both change in our lives and change in the world. Those are the places where we look to see what has changed and also to figure out what we could change with our effort and work and time. I want to work toward a better sense of what we mean by change, by considering some of the ways that change commonly happens. To do that, I want to think through 7 ways that things change, some of which might be possible to anticipate, and some of which are not. The first of the 7 types of change I'd like to consider is appearance, the arrival of something or someone, or the impending arrival that promises a shift or brings it. As I thought about appearance, I thought of the infinitely covered Curtis Mayfield song, "People Get Ready." "People Get Ready," the words of which are printed in your order of service, is a collective call, in one verse, to await the impending train to Jordan, and in another, just to know that the train is coming. The train in "People Get Ready" is a train that your faith selects you to board, a train that asks you to put your collective practice above your individual needs. For you, use the faith we can agree on might be in our commitment to being part of a community that helps us try again, rather than a faith in a higher power. It might be faith in the practice of collective process and ritual, of showing up and hearing one another out. The second type of change I'd like to consider is practice. Having a regular practice, whether that's calling a family member on the phone once a week, or watering your garden every morning, or meditating, or reading, or writing, or painting, is a process of adapting, usually in small ways, to changing circumstances. I hear in the train of Mayfield's "People Get Ready" a practice of attention and a devotional practice that allows the train to arrive. "All you need is faith to hear the diesels humming," Mayfield sings. "You don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord." And yet, in thinking about this song here in the arguably secular humanist UU congregation of my childhood, I understand myself to be making a gesture that feels emblematic of the kinds of changes the UU tradition feels comfortable making to the texts and procedures of more resolutely theist faiths. I hear the devotional practice in the song louder than I hear the object of that devotion. I hear that call to devotional practice so much louder that for me, its object functionally disappears. That gesture, hearing devotion louder than its object, is one I've seen many, many times in UU services and discussion. As UUs, we can make infinite room for the forms that our individual beliefs take. The work that we do together is to devote ourselves to relearn, to show up, to figure out how to be present for one another, to assume that we greet the present from a place of not knowing. In maintaining a living tradition, we agree to live in the work of trying to figure out what our collective strength looks like in order to address the moment we have. The third type of change I'd like to think about is growth. I am thinking of growth as the process by which humans, systems, or abilities move within or between stages of development. I'm thinking of the growth of a puppy, paws and head first, but also the growth of your spiritual practice in human relationships, of making a new friend or welcoming a child into the family, or the growth of sustaining involvement over a long period of time in something you love to do. My sense of UUs is that it's belief and the devotion that sees it through that we believe in. We expect our belief in one another to bring and keep us together. I heard what felt like a UU spirit when I attended a UCC church for 6 months in Iowa City and heard the minister say regularly that it's your devotion that matters. It's your devotional practice that matters, much more than your belief. He meant your belief in God, but he didn't mean only that, and that's not what I heard. I just heard that what matters is my devotion more than my belief, and I agreed. The fourth form of change I'd like to think about is aging. The aging of people, but also the evolution of beliefs and communities. The train of Mayfield's "People Get Ready" is not unlike the train of the spiritual "This Train Is Bound for Glory," also available to be boarded by anyone who believes and is willing to wait. You spend your life waiting and getting ready. For UUs, that's likely to mean working to find a way to manage change that suits you as you age. It's less likely to mean getting ready for the train to heaven or anywhere else, although it can. I love the thought of the train's arrival, in part because it's forever impending. It requires a kind of preparation that's always for the immediate future, threading your life along infinitely through its eye. There's another reason why People Get Ready feels especially well-suited to thinking about a UU version of devotional practice. Trains in American popular music and the change they bring are bound up in social change, in addition to religious pursuit. American train songs are good at thinking about how beguilingly large the country is, about what it means to orient to its well-being. On the train, you look out the window and love the landscape as a particular place and as emblematic of a larger place made up of infinite particulars of people and land. Growing up, I was often hesitant about a UU discourse of social change because I wasn't sure that UUs understood the extent of the everyone for whom they took responsibility. I grew to think of the radical way that UUs welcome as a way of being expansive with your sweetness, of asking yourself to let sweetness be the medium between you and the people you encounter. I grew to believe that the UU tradition asks you to age into learning to be more generous in small ways over time, and to devote yourself to learning how to do a better job of recognizing what generosity might mean. The fifth type of change I'd like to think about as a unit is retreat and removal, through which I'd like to keep thinking about trains. The train in the American train song is a means of escape as well as a means of arrival. In train songs, America is made up of land in miles you travel over. I'm thinking of City of New Orleans. I'm thinking about the train as a site of hedging a bet, moving quickly towards something unknown and often away from something with a pull, lovely or terrible. I'm thinking about the train as heading into the imminent, as UUs who might embrace a living tradition informed by what's behind us and facing what's ahead. It seems for this reason suitable that you can often, on a Sunday morning, stand in the rear parking lot and see the Chestnut Hill West Line on its way in one direction or another. The train song and the UU tradition are variations on an American orientation to the spiritual and yet often secular devotional practice of using the journey as an occasion to celebrate. Trains are, too, a way of thinking about wanting specific kinds of change, of wishing and working for the means to push against static and institutionalized systems of oppression and subordination. The train is the locus of the landmark 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson case that catalyzed the separate but equal laws that became the backbone of Jim Crow segregation. The figures of the train and the railroad in its history are also explicitly racialized engines of hope. This is true of physical trains and also, like Mayfield's, of gestural ones. This is a fact we're reminded of constantly in Mount Airy and Germantown, where we're in the midst of a number of sites that were central to the Underground Railroad. The train as a beacon of hope cannot be separated from the gesture of hope on a collective scale and hope on an individual one, radical and open in its welcome as we desire our congregation to be and as we work to make it so. The sixth type of change I'd like to think about is disarray or scattering. As I considered disarray, I thought about the work of Quaker writer and educator Parker Palmer and his ideas about the disarray caused by uncertainty in his book, The Courage to Teach. The practice of teaching, for Palmer, is a practice that requires the same degree of commitment to procedure that he asks of himself in his spiritual life. The classroom and the congregation are both communities that require and instill hope, bravery, and empathy. He believes that centrally held beliefs, what he refers to as our inner lives, belong in the classroom, and that the practices of teaching ourselves and one another are part of having any sort of practice, spiritual or other kinds. In other words, for Palmer, you're teaching yourself all the time how to keep doing what it is that helps you feel most human and most able to be part of others' lives. In the opening to The Courage to Teach, Palmer asserts, quote, "If identity and integrity are more fundamental to good teaching than technique, and if we want to grow as teachers, we must do something alien to academic culture. We must talk to each other about our inner lives, risky stuff in a profession that fears the personal and seeks safety in the technical, the distant, the abstract." we can also be likely to skirt the personal in our spiritual practice and in the way we teach ourselves to conduct it. The depth of our practice comes from our commitment to go into and come through our fear. Palmer, too, thinks about managing uncertainty when he goes on to define identity and integrity, which for him are the features of good teaching. He writes, quote, "By identity, I mean an evolving nexus where all the forces that constitute my life converge in the mystery of the self." And, quote, "By integrity, I mean whatever wholeness I am able to find within that nexus as its vectors form and reform the patterns of my life." Convergence and vectors matter to Palmer in part because he understands himself to be always entering a present moment where the practice of reacclimation is familiar, and where familiarity makes it possible to negotiate the fact that everything else is configured a little differently from how it was in the past. Palmer's language of convergence reminds me of the recent practice of a friend of mine. My friend Toby told me a few weeks ago that he has been sitting in a chair for 5 minutes, 3 times a day, and noticing his thoughts. For him, this isn't quite meditation, but it helps him be attentive, both while he sits and in his daily life. Like Palmer, Toby's practice is one of speaking wholeness by noticing what's scattered or disarrayed. The final type of change I'd like to think about is loss, the process by which people or communities disappear. My sense is that our practices around loss, while specific to it, are useful in how we consider other sorts of change. Those practices might include the time we give in memoriam to people we've lost. They might also include the rebuilding of how to do the basic work of our lives that accompanies loss of time or resources, or the loss of ability or support. Some loss we wait for, some catches up to us, becoming apparent only in the presence or absence of something else. The getting ready that we're doing is for impending loss as much as for anything. Once loss happens, we might not know what we've lost, and if we do, we still might not know immediately or ever what we've lost in it. Or it might take time. Ours is a community that has suffered several enormous losses in recent weeks and months. Our work now is to sit with each other in the bewilderment of that loss, to welcome the inability it brings, so that we might welcome what will follow that instability as we continue to hold on to that loss together. Living with loss is its own form of change. I take the forming and reforming of patterns that Palmer recognizes as part of integrity, as advocacy for adaptability, for expecting to be unseated. Integrity allows us to think about how to make our way through the world as the world changes in a concentric set of scales, endlessly losing and gaining individuals and abilities and systems. This work, accounting for change, finding a degree of strength in being bewildered by it, is the work that I believe is central to practicing our UU living tradition. Ours is a tradition of remaking, of witnessing and acknowledging the uncertain, of being supported and encouraged by our involvement in our community. Let us support each other's devotion to productive uncertainty. Let's support the practice of making our community, and through that practice, let's live within the process of losing and finding, and losing and finding our way. Thank you.